Tuesday, March 2nd, 2410. Test Settlement 1, Soliston. Halo, Scandia CN-38 System, Quarian Union, Kresge Sector. Though she had been here many times in her young life, Talizora Naraya always found that entering Soliston gave her a weird feeling. Like every member of her species, she had never seen an actual Quarian town, only hollows of what they'd looked like centuries ago on Rannoch or Venekar, Lubnaig or Haestrom, or one of the other long-lost worlds of the ancient Rannoch hegemony. The permanent structures of Halo Test Settlement 1 had been built by combined teams of Quarian engineers and human contractors based on those hollows, and what few architectural records remain from the era before the evacuation. As such, it had a slightly artificial feel, like a movie set or an idealized version of the old country in a theme park on some ex-colony world. And as the Halo Acclimation Project had progressed and the test groups had spent longer and longer in the town, it had grown and evolved, starting to take on a unique idiom all its own, one influenced by the style of the structures that had stood on Halo's surface for millennia before the Quarians came. There was nowhere else in the galaxy quite like Soliston. Tally walked down the settlement's main street. The place seemed particularly strange now for the simple reason that it was largely deserted. The acclimation project was between phases right now, testing having been suspended for the winter, and the new spring's first group of volunteers wouldn't arrive for another 2 weeks. That made it seem a bit like she had always imagined the towns on Rannoch would be now, eerie and empty. Did the Geth live in the cities they'd driven their creators out of? Did they have any understanding of the architecture? Know what the monuments stood for? Did they have any feelings at all about the people they'd displaced all those centuries ago? She'd always wondered. She shook her head, banishing the reverie. She had no time to muse on the Geth right now. She was here for a very particular reason. There was one house in Soliston that was unlike all the others. Where the rest of the town, particularly the Science Center, the grand building that stood at its center and housed all the research efforts, was built in duracrete and glass, in that odd fusion of classical Quarian and native Halo styles, the house called, for reasons that eluded most Quarians, Spare 14 was a simple plast-alloy colony prefab, known throughout human space, for reasons that also eluded most Quarians, as an IKEA. Actually, it was two of them, because it had an attached garage that was made of another, identical shell that had been fitted with a larger door and no interior walls. This house was unique, not only because it didn't match anything else in town, but also because it had stood there before the town. It was a relic of the previous settlement to stand on the site, a human farming colony called Goodyear. Nowadays, it was the private retreat of the only Quarian to have lived in Goodyear, whose house it had been in those days as well. And it was where Talizora was bound, because that Quarian happened to be her grandmother. She knocked at the door, no door chime in a structure as basic as this, and was admitted a few moments later by that grandmother, who greeted her with a hug and ushered her inside. An observer would have been hard-pressed to tell the two women apart, and not only because they were both Quarians, anonymous in their full-body environment suits and semi-reflect helmet visors. At 17, Tally was as tall as her grandmother, and they had the same slim, athletic build, honed by hours of diligent training. Their voices even sounded similar, enough so that, with a little effort, Tally had occasionally been able to fool her father into thinking he was talking to his mother, not his daughter. Tally's grandmother's name was also Tally, which occasionally made for confusion in its own right. Tally Shukra Velhalo, Tally the Elder, as she was known around the fleet, was quite a famous woman in the Quarian Union. She was widely, if a bit inaccurately, acclaimed as the discoverer of Halo, and had led the efforts to understand the Quarian people's most curious possession for quite a lot longer than Tali the Younger had been alive.
"Well, well, well," said Tali Shukra, stepping back to look her granddaughter over. "So the day has finally come. You must be excited."
She shook her head. "Listen to me. I'm saying exactly the same ridiculous things your great-grandmother said to me when I was leaving on my pilgrimage."
Talizora shrugged. "Tradition is important," she said, gently mocking one of her father's favorite pronouncements.
Tali Shukra laughed.
"That it is," she agreed. "Come with me. I have something for you."
She led the way around the half-partition that served to sketch in the house's tiny vestibule and into the living room. It always amazed Talizora how homey her grandmother had managed to make this dingy little prefab. She should have expected it. It was a Quarian national gift, the ability to make the drabbest, most cramped living space into a warm and welcoming home. But it somehow seemed like a more vivid accomplishment in a human-built colony shelter than in one of the Warren-like habitation holds of a starship. Centuries of living on the move had made the Quarians a ruthlessly unsentimental people when it came to material possessions. But their place in the Quarian heart was usually occupied with a vengeance by holograms and photographs, and Tali Shukra was no different. The living room walls, like those of her quarters aboard the Archangel before this, were like a summary of her life in carefully selected still images. The younger Tali's attention was pulled away from the pictures by the sight of what lay, neatly laid out, on the low table in the middle of the room. It was an encounter suit, not unlike the ones they both wore, but obviously of higher quality than the standard model Talizora was wearing. Which is not to say that hers was poorly made. Rather, the one laid out on the table was exquisite, with fittings and fabrics that had obviously been made, quite laboriously, by hand.
"This was my pilgrimage suit," Tali Shukra explained, gesturing. "Your great-great-grandfather, Kevrin Zora, made it for me many years ago. Now that you're leaving for your own pilgrimage, I want you to have it."
Talizora blinked.
"Grandmother, I don't know what to say."
"You don't need to say anything," Tali Shukra said fondly. "Just wear it with pride. It saw me through many a tight scrape before my pilgrimage was done. If anything, I expect yours will be even more eventful."
"Thank you. I will."
Talizora looked around.
"I've never noticed. Do you have a clean room here? I want to change before I leave so you can see me in it."
"That's something else I want to discuss with you before you leave," Tali Shukra said. "Something else I've given you, though I didn't realize it at the time."
"I'm not sure I like the sound of that."
"It's nothing bad. At least, I don't think so. You'll have to make your own decision about that, eventually. But I should start at the beginning."
She gestured to one of the armchairs and seated herself in the other one.
"It started not long after I first met Benjamin."
An hour later, dressed in her new encounter suit and with her head very gently spinning from all she'd just learned, Talizora embraced her grandmother in the doorway of her house.
"Thank you, Grandmother. I don't really know what everything you've just told me means, but thank you. I'll keep in touch as I can, and good luck with your mission," she added.
Then, with an impish smile in her voice, she added,
"This will be, what, your third pilgrimage?"
"Some of us remain pilgrims all our lives," Tali Shukra told her.
Then, with another hug for good measure, she said,
"Be well, Talizora. Be careful, but enjoy yourself. Kila Selai."
"Kila Selai, Grandmother," Talizora said.
She looked back once as she walked up the street, waving, and then went into the Science Center to say goodbye to Morden.
That didn't take long, not because Morden was dismissive, but because he did everything, including sentimental farewells to beloved pseudo-nieces, quickly and efficiently. She'd always liked that about him. Growing up Quarian, steeped in a society where everything could be, and generally was, debated at length, it had been very refreshing to have one friend who always got straight to the point. Presently, she emerged, bearing further gifts and well-wishes, and headed for the shuttleport at the edge of town. That was all her goodbyes said. She'd parted from her schoolmates at graduation the previous week, and her few friends on the Raya over the weekend. Now she'd been seen off by her grandmother and Morden. In the red messages file on her Omnitool, she had a coolly cordial email from her father, which was all the send-off she had expected from him in the first place. She wasn't going to see him in person. She had too much to do to be making special trips to his flagship just to hear him say in person that he disapproved of her choice of pilgrimage destination and the company she intended to keep once she got there. He'd made that plain enough already. She hadn't given a damn then, and she didn't give one now. Time, she thought as she boarded the shuttle that would take her up to the Scandia 1 fueling station, to be gone from this place. She had 2 hours to make her rendezvous with the Red Arc Line freighter currently making the run from the Lucas sector to Zeta Cygni. Next stop, New Avalon. I have a message from another time. Aerie Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword No. 5, Third Movement, First Dates and Firefights, by Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, that's me, and Philip J. Moyer. Friday, March 5th, 2410, 12:38 hours GST. Hangar Bay 44, International Police Station Babylon 6, Bahava L System, Centaurus Sector. Corwin Ravenhair was in a hurry. He had a fleet rendezvous to get to, and he was already behind schedule because he'd stopped on the way to the hangar in order to kinda sorta get married. As such, there were many levels on which he really didn't have time for Old Home Week featuring Succubi I Have Known right now. Of course, it didn't really look like Nanami Kiryu was here looking for a repeat of last Christmas Eve anyway. Granted, she did have Nahl on his back, but it was only to hold him at sword point. Nahl, Corwin asked. You okay? Sure, fine, Nahl replied, his voice a bit higher than normal. Just showing off for all my fans. Now, let's not do anything hasty here, Nanami purred. We wouldn't want anyone to get hurt. Next to Corwin, the sleek and gleaming form of his recently made robot friend Eve edged forward a few microns, weapon deployed, targeting system still locked on the center of Nanami's forehead. Not the girl, Eve, Corwin whistled in his approximation of droid audio burst code. The weapon. Understood, Eve coded back, shifting her aim fractionally. Ready. Go, said Corwin, throwing himself into motion as he did. Eve's ion pulse got there before him, naturally, striking Nanami's wickedly curved muspel iron scimitar just above where the blade met the hilt, and sending the weapon hurtling from her hand. She had just enough time to react with shock, yelping and pulling her stinging hand back, when Corwin hit her amidships with a flying tackle. Nahl scrambled to his feet as the two rolled several yards across the hangar bay's steel deck, winding up near the base of Dagger Disc's ramp. It dawned on Corwin relatively slowly that, having been disarmed and then tackled, Nanami wasn't really what you would call fighting back. She made no particular effort, for instance, to break free and recover her weapon or counterattack. Instead, she was grappling with him, well, more or less playfully. So it was that, about 20 seconds later, Thor Ironhammer strode into the docking bay to find Nahl sitting on the floor looking puzzled and Corwin sprawled on his back, partway up Daggerdist's ramp, and apparently not so much fighting the lithe blonde on top of him as trying, with limited success, to fend her off.
"Corwin," he bellowed cheerily as he entered the bay, "are you still here? I would ride into battle with you if—" "Oh!"
He advanced toward Daggerdisk, halting at the base of the ramp with just his boots in Corwin's somewhat limited field of view, and added,
"Am I interrupting something?"
"Fortunately, yes," Corwin grunted. "A little help, please?"
Thor hesitated.
That really isn't my—"
"Just get her off me!"
Corwin roared.
"Oh, I can do that."
Thor strode forward, seized Nanami by the scruff of the neck, and picked her up with no more effort than he would have shown picking up a sofa cushion. Then, taking a closer look at her, he asked in a tone of slight puzzlement,
"Now what?"
Corwin clambered to his feet, dusted himself off, and gave the blonde, who wasn't bothering to struggle against Thor's iron grip, a grumpy look. "Honestly, I've got no really strong preferences there."
"A person would think you weren't happy to see me," Nanami pouted.
"What are you doing?" Corwin began, then stopped himself.
"No, I don't have time for that. All right, bring her along, we'll figure it out on the way. Nahl, are you coming or what?"
As he dusted himself off, Nahl gave Corwin a half-hearted glare and said,
"Beg pardon, I was a little busy trying not to get stabbed."
"Yeah, well, waiting on you now," Corwin called back over his shoulder as he stalked up the ramp and into the ship. Thor looked at Nanami, who shrugged. The Thunder God shrugged in turn, slung her over his shoulder like a bag of laundry, and followed his nephew up the ramp with Nahl and the robots in tow. Utena Tenjo strode through the Valiant's corridors, nodding acknowledgments to the greetings of crewmen as she passed. The ship had more than a full complement aboard. Most of the people who'd brought her through from Zeta had stayed on to help with the upcoming fight, since her own crew was both scattered throughout the task force and likely to end up involved in the ground operation. The halls seemed unusually crowded and unusually formal with all these uniformed personnel. There was a definite buzz in the air, a going-to-war vibe that made everything seem that much more immediate, that much more serious. She entered the turbo lift and rode it to Deck C. When she emerged, a team of damage control crewmen was waiting to get on.
"Hey, Commodore," said the red-headed young man in the lead. "Back in the saddle again, eh?"
"Will Evans," said Utena, grinning. "What are you doing here? I thought you were on the Nukeman."
"I was transferred to the Insouciant last week, but she's not finished fitting out. When the call came in for this mission, I figured I'd tag along and get some Defiant-class experience."
She shook her head, still grinning, and clapped his shoulder as he entered the lift.
"We should all be so dedicated," she said. "Glad to have you, Will."
She arrived in the engine room to find it, too, abuzz with activity and sporting a far larger crew than usual. Corwin usually ran things down here with two or three assistants. Now there was a crew more like what would be found aboard a conventional ship this size, a dozen or more people, some in IPSF tech jumpsuits, some in the blue coveralls of International Police Tech Division shipyard workers. She had expected to see Zed Cochran down here riding herd on the gang, but instead the person standing in the middle of the room doing the supervising was somebody she knew but hadn't been expecting at all.
"Tally," she cried, delighted.
The young Quarian turned at the sound of her name, her body language brightening at the sight of Utena, and returned the captain's hug with enthusiasm.
"You made it after all," said Utena.
"Barely," Tally Zora replied. "There I was, so proud of myself for having made it to New Avalon by this morning, only to discover that you weren't there. You were on Babylon 6.
She shrugged.
"But, as they say, Keela provides."
"Well, hey, you're out. That's the main thing," said Utena.
"And heading straight into a battle, no less.
Tally said wryly. Father would be furious. Oh, wait. He is anyway.
Utna grinned and made a dismissive gesture. He didn't have to sign the waiver. And hey, thanks to this, you didn't miss the wedding. She frowned thoughtfully. Mostly. Not sure what we're doing about that yet. Oh, well, one thing at a time. Speaking of which, I'd better get to work. Got everything you need down here?
Please, said Tally. They're talking to a quarian in the engine room of a ship that's practically brand new. My biggest problem will be the lack of things to fix.
Utna put a hand behind her head and smiled a little ruefully. Oh, I'm sure we'll take care of that soon enough.
Or Earth Force will, Tally agreed. I was actually expecting to be bumped out of the job when we got here. Where's Corwin?
He's bringing Dagger Disc.
Ah, good idea. You never know when you might need to blow something up very, very much,
Tally said with a phantom wink.
At any rate, Commodore, we're ready and able down here.
Good to have you here, Utna said, giving her another quick hug, and then she returned to the bridge. Once there, she just had to pause for a moment and take a slow look around. Here in this familiar, compact space, with her crew taking their stations and getting to work all around her, she felt pride, confidence, all of that, really, but above all, she felt comfortable, at home. Like this, above anywhere else, was where she belonged right now. She took her center seat, settled back, and watched on the main viewer as the rest of Trident Group Red formed up and prepared to jump to lightspeed. The Klingon battlecruiser Hoskaj had a place in the formation, and Utna smiled at the sight. Years before, Griffin had arranged for Utna to spend a spare day aboard Hoskaj, which was then stationed at what was, at the time, still the Babylon Station construction area. She hadn't known it when she agreed, but he'd also arranged for her to be put in command of said battlecruiser for his, Klingons always called their ships he, day's patrol of the Bahava L system. When questioned about this, Commander Krontep had explained, "He told me he thought if you once tasted command, you'd never rest until you had it back." At the time, Utna had thought that was silly. Her, a space captain? She was, at the time, just a girl in her mid-teens, one who had grown up in a world where there was no such thing as space travel to boot. It had seemed like one of Griffin's little jokes, a lark to spend an afternoon with. Except that he'd been absolutely right. Noting a gap in the formation, she thumbed one of the comm keys on her con's armrest. "Dagger Disc? Valiant, what's the holdup?" "Picking up a hitchhiker. I'll tell you later," Corwin replied, sounding slightly disgruntled about something. "Getting underway now. Stand by." Utna arched an eyebrow at the comm panel, but said nothing. She knew that whatever was going on over there, it was sufficiently annoying to put Corwin in terse mode, and pestering him with follow-up questions wasn't going to do anything to improve matters. A few moments later, Dagger Disc emerged from Babylon 6's forward docking bay and moved into formation. "Okay, listen up, Red Group," Utna declared on fleet all-call. "We're going in by the blue route today. It'll be a lot less obvious than warping into the system or punching a meta point at the far end, and for damn sure less obvious than using Illustrious's wave motion spacefold. Set your helms to hyperspace slave, and let's go make the donuts."
"All task group ships are online and tied across in hyperspace slave mode," Gus Grissom reported from the helm station as acknowledgments flowed in from the various vessels on the overhead speakers. "I have control. The board is green." Miki Kaworu finished punching keys at the navigator station and reported, "Master course plotted and locked in. All stations online."
Utna nodded.
"Commence hyperspace countdown on my mark. Mark."
"Group Red, this is Valiant," Grissom said crisply, his fingers plying the helm controls as if he'd been operating a Defiant-class destroyer in flag mode all his career. "Fleet hyperspace maneuver in 10 seconds. 9, 8, guidance is internal. 6, 5,
The main viewer switched to the view ahead. Bahava L slid to starboard as the Valiant's automatic maneuvering system positioned her for a clean jump out system. The tactical plot, in the lower right corner of the display, confirming that the rest of the flotilla was changing course to match. Hyperspace motivators online. Preliminary maneuvering complete. 2, 1, light speed! The stars smeared into lines and then hurtled aft as the ship's motivator drive flung her into hyperspace, with the rest of the flotilla close behind. Otori Institute, Orifus.
He can see things before they happen, Arok Sifu Dyas had once said to Anakin Skywalker's mother. It's a Jedi trait.
Technically, that wasn't quite correct. It was a trait shared by some who were strong in the Force, not specifically anything to do with the philosophy of the Jedi Knights. But it was true as far as it went. For as long as he could remember, Anakin had been subject to little flashes of intuition, most of them unconscious, that guided his hand, for example, at the controls of a vehicle. He doubted that the insight he was having right now had anything to do with the Force, though. It didn't take a metagenetic connection to the universal life force to see Shuten Doji making for him across the central courtyard of the Institute and know that, unless he did something about it, he was in for an ass-kicking. That the youngest of the warlords from Kaneko had it in for him was not news to Anakin. With Akio Otori out of town and the neurotic, ineffectual wizard Mikage in nominal charge of the Institute in his absence, the time was right for anyone considering an internal power play, or any other activity the fallen prince wouldn't have approved of, to spring into action. Discussing the matter earlier, Anakin and his master, Kyuichi Sionji, had both expected all manner of old scores to get settled. All things being equal, Anakin would have liked his chances against Shuten. They'd sparred many times under the watchful eyes of their masters, and the score was about even. Three factors that were different now gave him pause, however. One, he knew that the young warlord had been training especially hard of late for purposes that hadn't been clear until just now. Two, their masters were nowhere in sight. And three, Shuten had a dozen people with him, advanced students from the faction within the Institute that followed Darth Venger, the self-styled Sith Lord, who had no love for Sionji or his apprentice either. The signs were abundantly clear that something was about to kick off, and if Anakin had learned one thing so far in his time with Sionji, it was that there were times to charge ahead and times to get the fuck out of Dodge. He abruptly turned and headed off across the courtyard at an angle, picking up his pace a bit. Sure enough, he saw Shuten and his posse change course, vectoring to intercept him. He'd foxed them for the moment, though. He'd make the side entrance to the practice hall well ahead of them. Suspicion confirmed, he stepped out to a very brisk walk. As he went into the building, he met someone coming out, and with only a moment to consider his options, he caught her arm and spun her around, taking her back inside with him. "Hey!" cried Lena Tarrant, one of Mikage's senior students, with a combination of dismay and indignation. "What's the—" "You don't want to go that way, anyway," Anakin told her breezily. "Too much riffraff out on the quad." "What?" Lena began, trying to pull her arm free so she wouldn't have to be dragged along beside him. A moment later, the door he'd just come through slammed open, and in came Shuten, Venger's students filling up the hallway behind him.
"Skywalker," Shuten bellowed, "I want a word with you."
"We should run now," said Anakin calmly, and seeing the looks on those faces, Lena couldn't help but agree. She considered trying to make it clear that she wasn't with Anakin and exiting the situation post-haste, but the determined way Shuten and his gang gave chase as soon as they broke into a run convinced her that this probably wouldn't work, so she just concentrated on staying ahead of them. The chase took them through the practice halls and halfway across campus, using side passages, service corridors, and alleyways Lena had in most cases not known were there. At least twice they passed places where it seemed to her that they could have broken off the pursuit altogether and made their escape. Anakin always passed them up in favor of a more direct route that kept them ahead, but didn't get them out of harm's way. "Few people understand the psychology of dealing with a renegade Kanigan warlord," Anakin replied to her questioning look as they ran as fast as they could through the many-columned gallery of the central hall. "Your normal duelist would panic and immediately go on the offensive." He shook his head. "This is wrong. It arouses contempt in the loser heart. Make the bastard chase you." He glanced back over his shoulder, saw Shuten still in hot pursuit, and smirked. "He will follow." By this point, they seemed to have outlasted several of Shuten's followers, who were apparently not as committed to the chase as the warlord himself. Laughing merrily, not even winded yet, Anakin put on more speed and made for the tall double doors that led out onto the Tower Plaza, the one place on campus that would be far too public for Shuten to make his move, even with Akio away from the school. Just before he reached them, the doors crashed open, and the half-dozen of Shuten's followers who had dropped out of the chase burst in, fanning out to block the whole approach to the portico. "Crap," said Anakin, who just managed to skid to a halt without plowing into them. "I guess you're not quite as smart as you thought, huh, Skywalker?" Shuten sneered as he and the rest of his gang completed the cordon around Anakin and Lena, who now stood warily back to back and tried to watch them all at once. "Technically, I think it's that you're not quite as dumb as I thought," Anakin replied, "which is not really that much of an achievement," he added offhandedly. As Shuten roared with fury and charged in for the attack, Anakin saw that he still had an escape route if he wanted it. There was a series of skylights in the ceiling of the gallery, a couple of which could be reached with relative ease from the transverse rafters that held up the vault. Even for him, it would have been a difficult jump to reach the rafters, but not impossible, particularly not with this kind of motivation. But that would have meant leaving Lena right in the middle of it all, and since it was his fault she was involved in the first place, he couldn't quite bring himself to abandon her that way. So instead, he used his last moment of grace to marshal the force to his will, then use it to propel her, much to her and their surprise, straight through the cordon of Venger's students and out the door. That moment was very satisfying. Those that followed, not so much. 1307 hours GST, Babylon 6. Konami Chidori Sterling knew only three things for certain at this point. 1. That was the weirdest turn she'd ever heard of a wedding taking. 2. She had taken a wrong turn herself at some point between the garden and the shuttle bay serving Port Jaradar. 3. She really didn't like the looks of the area she'd ended up totally lost in as a result. "It's your own fault, Konami," she told herself grumpily as she tried to look in all directions at once without actually looking like she was that concerned. "You should have paid more attention to the directions that usher gave you, or to where you were going when you tried to follow them." Admittedly, she'd had good reason to be distracted. At the breakup of the wedding, most of her friends in attendance had gone off, in essence, to war. Not something one often thought of as likely for a high school student, but part and parcel of the duelist's lot when something like the Earth Force reconquest of Tau Ceti came along. She'd been caught somewhere between envying them the action, worrying for their safety, and wondering whether she was letting down some kind of family legacy by not saddling up and taking part. And before she knew it, she was here, wherever here was. Konami hadn't realized Babylon 6 had slums, but the area she was in now sure looked and smelled the part. It was some kind of machinery level, the kind of place that was normally off-limits to the public. The architecture of the hallways, compartments, and whatnot was the same as it was everywhere else on the station she'd been, except here it was all covered in a haphazard veneer of improvisation and neglect. It reminded her of photos she'd seen of the ancient walled city of Kowloon on 20th century Earth, where tens of thousands of people had been squatting in one gigantic abandoned building. The stalls and makeshift shops had the air of a low-rent version of the Zocalo in Red Sector, but with a much more distinct air of menace, and almost no cell phone reception, much to her chagrin when she tried her phone earlier. She suddenly felt very conspicuous. Her old Jindai High uniform was sharp, which was why she'd kept it for special occasions, but it was also quite colorful compared to everything else here. She rounded a corner and found herself face to face with a bulkhead on which was painted a large and confusing diagram labeled, unpromisingly, "You are, alas, here." Above it, in the more official typeface to be found on station signage throughout, was the legend, "Brown Sector 21.
"Brown Sector?" Kaname muttered to herself. "I didn't even know there was a Brown Sector."
Kaname didn't really understand the curious psychic connection she had to her Invid heritage. The crossroads of the human, Meltran, and Invid genetic lines, with the added wild card of Dedian heredity thrown in for good measure, was a place that had been visited precisely twice in the history of biology so far, and it was, as a result, not very well charted. What she knew was that she sometimes brushed the vast collective semi-conscious of her father's people, and sometimes plunged headfirst into it, and there seemed to be little controlling when it happened or how thoroughly. Regardless, it wasn't the collective that whispered to her now, because it wasn't that kind of psychic. Rather, what pricked Kaname's awareness in this suddenly elongated moment was a plain vanilla sixth sense, having more to do with her upbringing than genetics, and springing entirely from her own resources. Unfortunately, this was something she hadn't much cultivated either, as part of her lifelong, mostly futile search for normalcy, and so its warning didn't come fast enough. She started to turn and move back before consciously realizing why, but not in time to fully avoid the blow. The weapon was a neural disruption stun rod, standard issue to riot police and prison guards around the galaxy. And the first thing Kaname noticed about it was that getting hit with one hurt a lot more than it looked like it did in the movies. Guys who got hit with stun rods in the movies simply fell down, unless they were serious A-list badasses like Duke Nukem, in which case it mostly just pissed them off. In neither case did the screen treatment convey the full nerves-on-fire anguish of the experience. Nobody ever went down screaming at the top of their lungs. Kaname's belated attempt to dodge meant that the rod only brushed her shoulder, rather than striking her square in the back of the neck. That was good. The latter was the sweet spot for such a weapon, the point on the body where its energies would be instantly dispersed through the entire nervous system and shut it all down except for the deepest autonomic functions. On the other hand, it was bad, because that meant instead of losing consciousness instantly, she got to feel every single nerve in the left side of her body light up in full alert and then go dark all at once. It actually hurt too much to scream, so at least that part of the movie version was accurate, if only accidentally. Kaname had always thought that was a cliché, but no, here it was. "Huh," said the man with the stun rod, a skinny, amphibian-looking semi-humanoid whose precise species she didn't recognize. "Not my best work," he admitted ruefully, collapsing the rod and sticking it inside his ratty leather jacket. "But it'll do. Okay, boys, all yours." Now the murmurs came, but indistinct, half-audible, filtering in fits and starts into her jangled mind like a video signal through heavy interference, telling her things that were interesting, but not necessarily useful. She suddenly knew, for instance, that the man with the stun rod was a Solarian, that two of the four boys he was addressing were wearing outdated Corellian Security Force jackets with the insignia stripped off, and that the one who was taking hold of her ankles had a Sternschnacht anti-materiel pistol in his shoulder holster, not a weapon you wanted to be using inside a pressure hull. None of which helped in any way. That made Kaname angry, and that, in a way, was helpful, because it concentrated her mind. Her left arm and leg still didn't want to work, which was awkward. But once she regained her wits, which took much less time than the Solarian and his boys were obviously expecting, she found that the ones on the right side worked just fine. She put out her right hand as if trying to find some support and get back to her feet, grabbed a fistful of the closest man's corset jacket, and suddenly pulled as hard as she could, twisting her body to add force to the throw. Taken completely by surprise, the man, who had been leaning over her anyway, was catapulted over her and slammed headlong into the man on the opposite side. The grip on her ankles slackened as the man with the sternschnock looked up in surprise. She capitalized on that by yanking her right foot out of his grasp, then kicking him in the face with it, which made him let go of the left as well. Anger and panic are both great motivators. The fact that Kaname was able to pull herself to her feet and even make a vaguely creditable attempt at running away in her present condition was proof of that. To be sure, her leg had been further from the partial stun rod strike than her arm and was recovering faster, but it still felt pretty much like a block of wood, as she stumbled as fast as she could through the warren of little lanes, grubby shops, and makeshift dive bars that made up Brown 21. There was, she noted, no sign of her supposed bodyguard, Sosuke Sagara. She must have managed to lose even him in the course of wandering into this hellhole, which was ironic, given that she hadn't even been trying to do that. She tried to get the first few vaguely reputable-looking persons she saw, who were by no means the first persons she saw full stop, to call security, but all that came out was the kind of noise that made accosted bystanders reply, "Go sleep it off someplace else, honey," or else issue a crudely worded proposition. Normally she'd have punched the latter, but she was too busy right now. She plunged blindly around another bend, having no idea where she was now, and just hoping she'd have the good fortune to happen upon a security station, or a turbo lift, or something helpful. What she found instead was a dead end. She turned around, thinking she might have been able to build enough of a lead on her pursuers to double back and try another direction, but that hope was dashed immediately. Not only were they right there at the corner she'd just rounded, there seemed to be more of them than there had been before. She'd apparently attracted the attention of a few more of the district's finer citizens with her blundering attempt at flight. They all paused for a moment, sizing up the situation. One human girl, about 20 feet of hallway, some old crates and random detritus, and no way out. The Solarian smiled and began advancing, drawing his stun rod from within his coat and energizing it again. Behind him, his crew and the newcomers spread out so that the whole corridor was blocked. Kaname had most of the feeling back in her leg, and enough in her arm that she could at least make a fist. She didn't think there was any way she could defeat this many opponents, even if the Whispers chose that moment to come flooding back in force, as they had a few times before in her life. Spirit knew this would be the one time in her life to date when she would have welcomed this sensation with a joyous heart, but there was nothing. "Okay, well, fine," she thought, "but that doesn't mean I'm going down without a fight. I'm a Sterling. That's not how we roll." As the Solarian broke into a trot, the completely irrelevant thought flickered across her mind. "I wonder if Sosuke will get fired for this." A moment later, the bulkhead segment just ahead of her and to her right burst inward with a sound like 100 popped paper bags, nearly clobbering the Solarian and filling the dead-end hallway with smoke. As Kaname coughed and stared in disbelief, a hand emerged from the char-edged hole the implosion had left in the bulkhead, seized her by the arm, and pulled her through. She stumbled on the lower edge of the hole and fell into the arms of the person who'd pulled her. And was it her imagination, or did those arms hold her for an instant longer than they strictly needed to, before setting her back on her feet? Kaname decided it must have been her imagination, because the look on Sosuke's face as he urged her, in a businesslike way, to follow him was even grimmer than usual. His was not the face of a man who was feeling in any way frisky.
Can you run? He asked her tersely.
I think so, she replied.
Good. This way. We have to get out of Brown Sector before that Solarian's entire underworld network is mobilized to cut us off.
Underworld network? What are you talking about? You mean those guys aren't just muggers?
Hardly, said Sosuke flatly. They're talent scouts. This level is one of the chief sources of supply for the galaxy's illicit organ and tissue transplant industry, and you are obviously a very healthy specimen. Hearing po-faced Sergeant Sagara utter an evident double entendre almost pulled an inappropriate giggle out of Konami, but it was squelched by the sudden, cold horror of realizing that it would never even occur to him to joke about something like that. So it must be true. The thing about Brown 21, anyway. She was not prepared to offer an opinion, even to herself, as to whether he'd intended anything with the healthy specimen remark. She said, but he shook his head. Just run, he said. He didn't ask how she had even gotten down here, which was just as well, since she didn't know. They ran. They got as far as the central hub corridor, within sight of the turbo lifts, for they found their path suddenly blocked by a group of beings numbering nearly a dozen, who melted out of side pathways. Sosuke skidded to a halt, pulling her up short alongside him, then turned. Another group was approaching from behind, led by the Solarian. He didn't look amused now, and he had a blaster in his hand. Apparently, he decided he didn't need all her organs intact. Sosuke's only visible reaction to this apparently hopeless situation was to loosen the knot of his tie by approximately 1 inch and unfasten the top button of his shirt. Then he murmured to Konami, "Whatever happens, stay down until I call for you." And before she could ask any questions, he shoved her to the floor behind a packing case, produced a polymer ceramic holdout blade from his sleeve, and leaped at the Solarian with, Konami was surprised to notice, no sound at all. Although she knew in her head that Sosuke Sagara was a genuine soldier, born and bred on the battlefields of some war-torn outer rim rock, Konami Sterling had never really believed it deep down in her heart. The whole situation in which she found herself confronted with him on a daily basis was just too silly, on some fundamental level, for her to accept that fact in any but a purely rational way. Until today. Today she saw with her own eyes that he was not just a soldier, but, under the right conditions, a warrior, a fierce and merciless killer of men. He cut down the Solarian too swiftly for her to even follow exactly how he'd done it, took his blaster, and dropped three of his confederates before they'd even had a chance to react to their boss's demise. Startled, the rest of that group fell back, all but the man with the Sternschnacht pistol. He apparently knew his gun wasn't suitable for this environment, which made some part of Konami wonder why he even had it. Instead, he pulled out a combat knife that made Sosuke's look like a toy, and bull-rushed him, the young mercenary's one snap shot passing over his head, before Sosuke was forced to use the weapon to parry the man's knife instead. This curious duel went on for no more than 7 complicated seconds, until at last Sosuke managed to catch the knife blade on his appropriated blaster's trigger guard, twist it until the knife almost slipped free, and fire the blaster at point-blank range into the knife-wielder's side. A few degrees either way and he'd have missed. A few degrees either way and the blade would have come free and sunk into his chest instead. Through it all, his face was as expressionless as it was when Konami teased him over the morning newspaper at the breakfast table in Hamlin Hall's dining common. Even when he held up the dying man long enough to take his Sternschnacht, then dropped him to the deck, Sosuke remained a cipher, his feelings, if he had any, completely concealed. The second group, blocking their path to the elevator, was approaching now, not to say charging. Without hesitation, Sosuke did something to the blaster pistol he held,
then spun the knife-scarred weapon across the metal decking. It stopped just before the charging mob arrived at it, and then exploded. The blast was relatively small as these things went, but in this confined space it was still enough to set Kaname's already aching head to ringing. It hurled members of the mob back and out to the sides, slamming them against bulkheads and to the floor. Most didn't offer to get up. Of those that did, only one, a big, strapping man easily twice Sosuke's size, continued advancing. His face still expressionless, Sosuke leveled the sternschnacht at him and thumbed off the safety. Sternschnacht, heavy anti-materiel pistol, the faintest of whispers said in the back of Kaname's head. Manufactured on Dutch Valeria. Single-shot, break-open pistol. Fires 21mm hypervelocity fin-stabilized discarding sabot kinetic kill vehicle. Primary use, disabling of vehicles. Extremely unsafe to use in pressurized habitat environments. Also, recoil will break an ordinary human's arm in three places. Sosuke's one remaining opponent seemed to know all that, too. He sneered and said, his voice barely audible through the ringing in Kaname's head, "You can't fire that in here. You'll break your wrist and kill all three of us." Sosuke smiled very slightly and very coldly. "What makes you think any of that bothers me?" he asked. Kaname knew, or thought she knew, that he was bluffing, and she still found his demeanor intimidating. The effect on this guy, who didn't know him from Adam, was dramatic. Though twice Sosuke's size, he wilted visibly and backed up. "Come on, Miss Chidori," said Sosuke, not taking his eyes off the big man's face. He held out his free hand and said, "We're going." Hesitantly, she took it and let him lead her past the big man, whom Sosuke kept covering with the sternschnacht until they had sidled past and were on their way to the lift. "Keep your eyes front," Sosuke murmured as he backed down the hallway alongside her, still training the sternschnacht downrange. The turbo lift opened as they approached. Kaname stepped in, Sosuke backed in after her, and he kept the weapon aimed at the big man until the doors closed in between them, and the lift was off up the shaft to Red Sector. The release of tension and the pounding in her head combined were too much for Kaname. She wobbled away and was violently sick in the far corner of the balloonist lift car, then made her way unsteadily back to Sosuke, put her back against the wall, and slid down into a seated position on the floor, putting her head in her hands. "Sorry about the mess," she said in a low, dispirited tone. Sosuke knelt down beside her, placing the fingertips of his free hand gently under her jaw and feeling her carotid pulse. "Post-neuroshock syndrome is setting in," he said matter-of-factly. "The sooner you reach Medlab, the better."
"Sounds like a plan to me,"
Kaname replied, trying, and mostly failing, to sound jaunty.
"Hey, you should probably secure that cannon now."
Sosuke looked at the sternschnacht as if he'd forgotten he was holding it, then smoothly decocked it and put it down.
"It isn't loaded," he said.
Kaname blinked.
"How can you tell?"
she asked. "It's too light. The 21mm HVF SDS KKV employed in the sternschnacht weighs almost 2 pounds by itself. The absence of that mass disrupts the balance of the weapon. Its former owner must have carried it simply as a Psy War tactic." Kaname giggled.
"The sad part," she said dazedly, "is that I understood what you just said."
Then, pulling herself together with a visible effort, as her head was really and truly spinning now, she caught his hand in both of hers and said,
"Listen, thank you. I mean, really, thanks. You were amazing."
Sosuke inclined his head.
"It's my job, Miss Chidori," he said. "Now you've seen it. This is what I do."
"Well..."
Kaname smiled a blurry sort of smile, her eyelids drooping.
"I'm glad you were here to do it to me."
She frowned.
That's not what I wanted to say, is it? What I mean is..."
And she passed out.